You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. So how many of you have read Moby Dick? How many of you wish you've read Moby Dick? How many of you wonder why read Moby Dick? Okay, we have to have a few, you know, kind of total converts. Thanks to this year's LFLA initiative, I finally have read Moby Dick. My beloved English teacher, may she rest in peace, read it six times, and she gifted me with a thick copy of it a few years ago. I lugged it back and forth across the country, read it aloud at night by kerosene lamp in a cabin in the Sierras. Who knew it was funny? Listened to readings on the Moby Dick Big Read on my iPhone and read the occasional chapter on my iPad. Let me count the ways. Popular media representations often set so-called digital literacies at odds with the values and norms of traditional print culture. As tonight's presenters have noted in their new book, New Literacies in an Age of Participatory Culture. Henry Jenkins, Wynne Kelly, and Ricardo Pitsiwiley wanted to work against that divide, quote, envisioning a generation of students who could read a book in one hand and a mouse in the other. Tonight, with our distinguished guests, we'll look at how the new media literacies can supplement and expand traditional print literacies in ways that enrich our culture and deepen our appreciation of classical stories like Moby Dick. So, brief introductions for our co-conspirators here, who all have long distinguished resumes. Henry Jenkins, in the middle, is Provost Professor of Communication, Journalism, and Cinematic Arts at USC. He's written and edited more than 15 books on media and popular culture, and his published works reflect the wide range of his research interests, touching on democracy and new media, science fiction fan communities, and the early history of film comedy. Wynne Kelly, on the left, is a Melville scholar. She teaches literature at MIT and is author of Melville's City, Literary and Urban Form in 19th Century New York, and of Herman Melville, An Introduction. She is the editor of the Blackwell Companion to Herman Melville. Ricardo Pitsiwiley is a passionate advocate for getting communities to read and discuss classical novels together. He's the co-founder of the Mixed Magic Theater, and while serving as their director, he gained national and international acclaim for his page-to-stage adaptation of Moby Dick titled Moby Dick Then and Now. And I'm sure he'll be telling you about that tonight. He's also the composer of over 150 songs and the author of many plays. To kick off tonight's program and to give you a taste of what's coming up at the Broad next month, we've invited Wiebe Gerritsen and Ralph Gorodetsky to open off up tonight, performing their Let Me Look Into a Human Eye from Moby Dick, Chapter 131, The Symphony by Herman Melville, music by Gerritsen and Gorodetsky, lyrics by Herman Melville. Please welcome Wiebe Gerritsen and Ralph Gorodetsky. Thank you.
Moby Dick or the White Whale, Chapter 131, The Symphony.
Let me look into a human eye.
Captain Noble Soul, wife and child to our Starbucks. To Nantucket, let's away. They have some such mild blue days. They have, I've seen them. Some summer days in the morning, about this time, yes, it's his nap time now. The boy vivaciously wakes, sits up in bed, and his mother tells him of me, of Cannibal All Me, how I'm aboard the deep, but will come back again to dance with him again, 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 to dance with him again. Thank you.
That was fantastic. And I hope sets the tone for the discussion we're going to be having tonight. I've sort of been jokingly describing this evening as Melville Vaudeville, because we're going to see lots of different pieces of performance throughout the evening, looking at how Melville's been taken up by a variety of artists and by the general public through the years. Our book, Reading in a Participatory Culture, Remixing Moby Dick in the English Classroom, published by Teachers College Press, grows out of a project we did with the MacArthur Foundation on project on digital media and learning. And we really wanted to help teachers rethink what reading meant in the 21st century. So part of what we did was we began the book with a series of portraits of each of us and a fourth person who's not here, Rudy
Cabrera,
who was an actor in Ricardo's troupe, talking about how they came to encounter Moby Dick, what it meant for them to read from a very particular vantage point. So I thought that by way of opening us up tonight, we'd each share a little bit of our journey into this project, which has been a remarkable collaboration. And Ricardo, why don't you start us off and tell us a little bit about your encounters with Moby Dick?
Well, it really began when I was a very young man, when my mother wrote a book report on Moby Dick in her high school, an all-black high school in Mississippi in the 30s. And she wrote a book report, and her brother was shaving and got her book report all wet and ruined it. She had to write it again. So it was a story she told all the time. So, and then whenever the Gregory Peck Moby Dick came on television, it was an event at our house. And so I felt like I knew Moby Dick. Even though I didn't know Moby Dick, he was a part of my life. And then I had an opportunity to work with a group of incarcerated young men in Rhode Island, where I live. And I had an idea that I could draw a parallel between the cocaine trade, international cocaine trade, and Moby Dick. And I started with these young people, and they took my idea and ran with it. But it wasn't so much that they talked about their life with cocaine. It was that they freed the imagination of a playwright to say, don't get locked in a box about this great novel. And then I met Wynne Kelly and the members of the Melville Society, and you talk about a group of people with a passion for a book. Oh. Well, they fired me up, and then I got a chance to work with a group of young people, my first cast, and they added their poetry to the process. And then I met Henry Jenkins and the people at MIT, and they showed, we were able to look at it and say, you know what, we're maybe talking about some of the same things, that the concepts being promoted by the new media literacies and what we're doing are very compatible. And as a result, a great partnership and collaboration resulted in this book, and I hope over the next 20 years, every young person in this country will be a part of the Moby Dick experience.
Yeah.
So Len, why don't you pick it up from here and tell a little bit about your relationship to this book?
Well, it's been going on for a long time. I like to say that I've been reading Melville since he was an American writer. And then he became a male writer. And then he became a female writer, and it was okay for people like me to work on him. And then he became a racial writer. And then he became a writer about sexuality. And now he's a poet. So I'm talking about the trends in literary scholarship, which have made it possible to open up Melville more and more. We were trying to figure out today how the conversation on Moby Dick got started at MIT, and we don't know. We just think that Henry was maybe looking for a really ambitious book. And in my teaching, I had been trying to find out more about what my students were thinking when they read the books, and Henry seemed to know, so we put them together.
So my experience was that I flunked Moby Dick in high school, right? And I never got past the whiteness of the whale. My high school literature teacher, Mrs. Hopkins, assigned us to write a paper on allusions in Moby Dick, biblical allusions. Moby Dick never really adequately explained to us what an allusion was. I wrote a bad paper. I got probably the worst grade I ever got on an essay in my life. And I stuck it in a drawer until I met these guys, right? And Ricardo and Wynne came to my office, and the passion they both felt for this book really spoke to me. And then I heard Ricardo's story of working with these incarcerated youth and getting them to read this incredibly ambitious novel, which certainly is well above their reading level by the way they were treated by any institution in their life, whether the school or prison. They read a really difficult book. We all find it difficult. And they did it. He got them to do it by telling them to rewrite it and imagine what the story would be for the 21st century. So a story about men who put their lives at risk in a dangerous business, a story about a captain who's torn between the money-making side of whaling and the desire for vengeance became for them a story about street gangs and the drug trade. Now, that resonated for me as someone who mostly has studied fans and their rewriting of Star Trek or Harry Potter or whatnot. I was working with kids who read passionately in order to rewrite, to recreate. And I was teaching at MIT where I had a generation that had learned how to do engineering by taking things apart and putting them back together again. So for me, the idea of remixing Moby Dick, this book that had defeated me when I tried to read it straight, was really, really powerful. So they convinced me to go back and return to the scene of crime. And I literally picked up the paperback edition that I tried to read in high school. And I'm reading this thing in the hammock in my backyard, and the yellowing pages, the glue's coming undone. And they're just, I'm reading, and there's another page I'll never see again, but I'm working my way through this novel and getting really, really excited. And at the moment, I was working for the MacArthur Foundation. We were trying to help teachers think about how you change the way you teach to respond to a generation that has had an expansion of the capacity for communication, an expansion of the ability to produce and circulate culture. What does that mean in our classrooms? How do we go from a world where we wire the classroom and hobble the computer to one where the computer is an integral part of teaching, but it's not about replacing books with teaching, it's about bringing them together. And we were looking for content that felt very traditional, but could be taught in a radical way. And that's really what inspired us to do a project. We developed a teacher's guide. We piloted it in about six schools of all public and private. And then this book grew out of that experience. And it's written for teachers, but we think it's also helpful for the public to think about what it is to read today. So part of what we wanted to share tonight is some of this, you know, we've been lucky enough to bring Ricardo here to Los Angeles. He's going to be with us for 3 weeks, and we'll talk a little later about work he's doing in schools across the city. But first, Ricardo, you wanted to share with us a little bit of the transformation you did from Melville's prose to the play.
Well, I'm going to read a couple of scenes, but this first one, it begins with some very familiar lines. And from the Melville novel. Very important in this process was maintain the integrity of the original. You know, when in doubt, go back to the original. But also try to find a way to give it a new voice that tells the same story. So it was very important in our process of my process of creating Moby Dick then and now to only tell one story, a story of a vengeance quest. Call me Ishmael. Some years ago, never mind how long precisely, having little or no money in my purse and nothing in particular to interest me on shore, I thought I would sail about a little and see the watery part of the world. Whenever I find myself growing grim about the mouth, when there is a damp, drizzly November in my soul, whenever I find myself involuntarily pausing before coffin warehouses and bringing up the rear of every funeral I meet, and especially when my hypos gets such an upper hand of me that it requires a strong moral principle to prevent me from deliberately stepping into the street and methodically knocking people's hats off, then I count it high time to get to sea as soon as I can. This is my substitute for a pistol and ball. There's nothing surprising in this. If they but knew it, almost all men in their degree, sometime or other, cherish very nearly the same feeling toward the ocean with me. By reason of these things, then, the whaling voyage was welcome. The great floodgates of the wonder world swung open, and in the wild conceits that swayed me to my purpose, two and two there floated into my inmost soul endless processions of the whale, and mid most of them all, one grand hooded phantom, like a snow hill in the air. That's Ishmael. But now, the young narrator from the young crew. I'm Q, like the letter. My government name doesn't really suit me, especially for the line of work me and my team are in. We come from a lot of different places, but somehow, some way, we all ended up in the same city, in the same hood, on the same block. So it's only natural that we call ourselves the One. We specialize in urban pharmaceuticals. You got dough? We got weight for that. You got beef? We got burners for that. We keep it professional, and of course, we keep it fly. None of us are forced to flip burgers or work like slaves for somebody else and live from paycheck to paycheck. We stack paper on our terms in our time. Life's too short in the hood, it's even shorter. Life's too short in the hood, it's even shorter. Why waste time being broke? Some people think the game is easy, that it's for lazy chumps. It's funny. I've never seen anybody survive on the corner without some hustle, and I've certainly never seen a hustler get a bailout. I swear the Wild West ain't got nothing on some of the stuff I've been through. A while back, I started writing it down, the laughs, the drama, the money. Not sure why, just figured they were stories worth telling. The One's got to leave its mark. The One's been good to the game, and the game has been good to us. Rules were set down, and we played by them. Everything was cool until Pip, the crew leader's little brother, decided to take some of our product and sell it for himself to show his big sister Alba that he belonged. Pip broke the rules. He didn't belong. The white thing didn't care.
So one of the questions one might ask, why Moby Dick? You've given some personal reasons, but what do you think Moby Dick meant for the young people you've been talking about this?
Well, I think one of the things that impressed me from the beginning about Moby Dick was I didn't have to invent any people. Everybody was there. Everybody was on the boat, and so I didn't have to invent any black people. I didn't have to make up any Indians. I didn't have to make up any. They were already there. But also, it's a story of disposable people, and it was so it was for many of them it was easy to relate to the fact that there are things that there are people on this boat that either had to learn to work together or they were going to sink together or starve together. But they also, their lives may not have mattered in the grand scheme of things unless they made them important. And so the novel gave me a chance to say, okay, this is here's an American society that Melville wrote about 160 years ago, but it's the same society we're living in today. And what's your part in it? And what is the well that you may be pursuing or may be pursuing you? And when I started talking about the nature of cocaine, and I had with me the idea that the whale in Melville's novel is bigger than we can imagine. And the more you hunt it, the closer you get to it, the more you realize its scope, its size, its power, its strength. And the same thing was true of the cocaine business. You may see a little bit of it on the street corner, but when you really start chasing this thing down, its proportions are beyond imagination. And you may be a pawn to its power, unless you make some different choices.
So we're here tonight talking about remixing Moby Dick, but when you first encountered the phrase appropriation, which is one we use in the new media literacy side, I think it hit some strong chords with you.
Yeah.
And we have a great piece of video in the digital book extension of this where you sort of lay in what's at stake for you in the word appropriation.
Well, you know, as an African American who's seen his culture appropriated so many times, I do have strong feelings about that. But also in the learning and the teaching process, in the digital learning and teaching, young people are encouraged to just go on the computer and do things and not give any, and without any knowledge or recognition of what the original source was. So you can remix and mash up and do all of those things, but where did it come from? What's its root? And if you don't understand that or appreciate it, all you haven't done anything new necessarily. All you've done is stolen stuff. And going back to Moby Dick, one of the things that was very important was don't steal anything. If Melville didn't write it, you know, don't try not to add it in. But I had to stay honest to the kids too, and their culture, and what was true in their lives. I couldn't appropriate. I didn't use the young people from the prison. I didn't use any of their stories, and they wrote brilliantly. I didn't use their stories in my play because I would have been doing the very thing that I was against, appropriating their stories for my benefit. You know, the gift they gave me was the freedom of imagination. And that I could honor in the work that I did.
So you have enormous respect for Melville's language, but what also came through when I look at your script is an enormous respect for the language of contemporary youth culture.
Oh, my God. It is so beautiful sometimes. And when you do it sans profanity, it gains beauty. When I was working on the play, I wrote the first text, and I brought it in to the kids and said, okay, how would you say it? And they said, we get to change words? Said, yeah, just go ahead. Just try not to, you know. But you got to stay on point. And they would say, well, you know, all you really need to say is like, well, you know, yo, man, you know, that's how that work, you know. He said, just say it like that. And so I had to encourage them to say, no, what you just said, write that. But every once in a while, they would get to a place, they would say, Mr. P, we don't want to change anything. And I was like so happy because like I'm cool, man. But their language, it was simple, beautiful. And it flowed like Melville's language. It flowed, and in letting their language come to life, I was able to take them back into the Melville and say, "Look what he did." And if you could appreciate this, you know, and don't put a higher value on his language than yours. That's a mistake. But appreciate what he did so eloquently, and see how eloquent you are. And then it'll stay with you forever.
And I think what may strike people if they look at your play is that you've woven in some very contemporary references.
Yeah.
The first production, we saw a kid wearing a Scarface t-shirt. There's a line about Finding Nemo in it. Could you talk a little bit about those elements and what are those connected?
Well, I let the young crew dress themselves. So they, you know, do you know what the number one movie under 40 in this country is? By a long ways. Scarface, over 40, you know what the number one movie is? Especially among men. Godfather. Number one by a long ways. You know, and they're both about doing it your own way. So so you have to kind of understand youth culture from the sense of they appreciate those things of people who do it their way. Well, you know, Moby Dick, Ahab did it his way. He broke all the rules and he did it his way. And so there's a certain kind of response to that. But also, I understood pretty quickly that their collective knowledge was vast. That the media had given them this enormous collective knowledge, even if they didn't always know where it came from. So when you get a chance to say, okay, we're going to use the Nemo term because everybody understood it, but it's Nemo, you know, when they're talking about going after White Thing, the biggest fish in the ocean, compared to him, we're just Nemo. Kids in the audience understood it very, very specifically. And Henry's being very generous, you know, but what I learned from Henry about the permission that you and the responsibility that you have to incorporate media into the learning process changed and shaped the way I wrote the show, the way I directed the show, the way I dealt with things, because I saw that there was an opportunity to go beyond what was normal and go into a world that was as big as the whale.
So, Wynn, let's take this into your space. Why Moby Dick, from your point of view?
Well, for the book or for... Okay, I'm a teacher as well as a scholar, and I had been working with other texts besides Moby Dick. I mean, there are other books exist. in terms of their use of sources. So in a sense, I was experimenting with remix before I learned the term from Henry and realized how useful it was as a tool. So I wanted to say a little bit about how Melville remixed his sources, because this was my contribution to the book, pretty much, was to suggest that students would feel empowered to do this themselves if they looked at someone like Melville and realized, well, hey, he uses biblical allusions. he's quoting from the book of Jonah. He's thinking about Paradise Lost. He's looking at Shakespeare. He's rewriting Cervantes. He's using all of these sources. But the trouble is, students look at that and they say, well, I don't read those books. I mean, you're remixing, but I don't care about those books. There's a very nice review attached to the library website about Melville's remixing by Mr. Giraldi, who wrote it for the LA Book Review. I don't know if he's here. But he talks about Melville's remixing of earlier works, and I think it's become a kind of accepted idea in Melville studies. But I was interested as well especially after seeing Ricardo's play, in the way that Melville remixed popular sources as well. So, of course, if you've read the book, you know that he was interested in, all sort of popular forms of elite culture, like encyclopedias that were more like miscellanies or cabinets of curiosity, just miscellaneous information all heaped together with lots of pictures. He read philosophy, religion, law, learned books, but he also really appreciated the dream books that sailors were reading and using them to interpret their dreams. He was interested in sermons, clearly, and had heard a lot of them, so he remixed that into Father Mapple's sermon. He clearly appreciated the songs and shanties that the sailors sang, and their yarns, and their superstitious sayings, and their proverbs. So those get mixed into the book as well. And I've been kind of interested in his use of dialect. So he has Polynesian pidgin and African-American dialect, which he heard in New York, but also at sea. So it's a very rich oral culture there that's in the book, and it comes pretty much from popular sources. So since we are seeing a lot of hearing music and seeing film tonight, I thought I would show you a little bit of some of the books that and visual culture that's also been inspired by Moby Dick, because there again, Melville was interested in visual culture. And I don't know that that gets represented in the editions we have, but he was responding to painters like the French painter Garnieret, who did the pictures of the right whale and the sperm whale. And in chapters 55 through 57, he talks about all the proper representations of whales and the bad ones. He says Garnieret's pretty good. The French are pretty good lads with a pencil, he says. And he talks about Cellini's Perseus. The first time that Ahab appears, and when I show this to my students, I say, what does this look like? And they don't know. So we put up the picture of Cellini's Perseus. Well, he's naked, and he's holding up Medusa with one hand and a sword with the other. And he does not look anything like an aging Quaker sea captain. It's just, they couldn't be farther apart. So what's Cellini's Perseus doing in there in the first description of Ahab? If you can't see that visually, and we can now because we can put it up on the screen, you're missing a big part of the book. And again, there he also uses really popular sources as well. So he takes up Scrimshaw. And at one point, the landlord at the Spouter Inn calls him Scrimshander. That's his nickname. Ishmael is a maker of Scrimshaw. And he there's all the tattooing in the book, which is a rich visual culture. And how many of you know that Ishmael has a tattoo? So he says, I tattooed the measurements of the whale's skeleton on my arm. I didn't want to do the both arms because I'm leaving space for a poem. He wanted to have his canvas cleared. He describes Queequeg as George Washington cannibalistically developed. So he's thinking of the profiles of George Washington. So it's very clear how Melville is remixing all kinds of sources. But what I learned from working with Henry and Ricardo and working on this book was that this very generosity, Melville's generosity with his own sources, is what has inspired so many other kinds of artists to adapt him. And I couldn't fit them all in my suitcase, but there is some amazing books. Maybe you're aware of them, but this was new to me. The Felt Moby Dick. This is right here in the LA library, and it's all felt images. And as Ricardo said, it's all there, the whole story.
Yeah,
I like that one. And this someone just handed to me tonight. I've seen this in the New Bedford Whaling Museum store. This is a children's Moby Dick. And there are so many children's books and abridged books and versions for young readers. And people say to me, well, is it okay to read an abridged version? I say, yes, it's okay to read an abridged version. You'll read the other one later. This is one of the ones I always start my classes off with. Have you seen the Moby Dick pop-up book? Oh, my God. And my opening remark is that this is as elegant a use of its form as Moby Dick is of the novel. And by the way, Moby Dick is not a novel. It's not a novel. It's a hybrid. But this book really gets the plot, gets the characters and everything about the book. And then another one that you may very well have run into is Matt Kish's Moby Dick in Pictures. So Matt Kish is a librarian in Ohio and an artist influenced by comic book art, tattooing, fantasy. And he decided that he wasn't getting anywhere in his career, and he would take a year to illustrate every page of his Signet edition of Moby Dick. So this is a centerfold. And he did these on any paper he could find. So some of them are done on engineering schemata and drawings. I think this is one. You can see the little markings. Some of them were done on pages of the text, all different sizes. He would go into a closet to work on this. And at the end of the year, he blogged all the way through it and shared it with people. And then at the end, he got a fabulous contract for this gorgeous book. And now he's doing Heart of Darkness. So keep your eyes open for it. And then just a couple of other things in case you're bibliographically minded. If you're interested in the story of 20th century painting and illustration of Moby Dick, Elizabeth Schultz's Unpainted to the Last is essential. And then I've just come across a new graphic novel called Nemo, Heart of Ice. Has anyone seen that? Which has an aging Ishmael. It's by Alan Moore and Kevin O'Neill. Do you know this one?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. So it has an aging Ishmael in the 1920s on a quest to the stars. And then I've just recently met an artist in New Bedford, Massachusetts, who's doing Chinese paper cuts of scenes from Moby Dick, beautiful black silhouettes, which are on display right now at the New Bedford Whaling Museum. And then right here in L.A., and maybe he's here, is Tony de los Reyes, who did a fine art edition of Loomings, the opening chapter, with burnt-out text. So you just get some of the words from the opening chapter on the page, and they make an amazing poem. So there's, as I say, all levels of visual adaptation of the book. The last thing I'll say is that I may be the only one. Well, okay, you shared it too. I didn't like Moby Dick the first few times I read it, and it took me a very long time to enjoy it. And I'm not sure it's my favorite Melville text, but don't tell anybody. And the other thing I want to tell you is that it doesn't matter if you read it from beginning to end. You can jump in the middle. And our book is about literacy that comes from models of reading that are much older than our habits of reading linearly and from A to Z. Moby Dick is a great book to start a more liberating form of reading with. So I'll leave you with that.
So one of the things you helped us to do on the project, and this notion of non-linear reading is a central idea running through the book. One of the ways we got at it is through this idea of ornamentation and annotation, right? And that grew out of some of the stuff you shared with us about Melville's own treatment of books.
Oh, well, my students come into my classes and I say, do you write in your books? And I say, oh, no. My teacher wouldn't let me write in my book. Or I have to sell the book, so I can't write in it. Melville covered his books with comments. There's a wonderful website called Melville's Marginalia Online. And one of my favorites is in the Beale's Natural History of the Sperm Whale. He starts commenting on all the pictures. He says, that one's not bad. This one makes the whale look like a squash. So we started thinking about ways the students could make the same kind of interactions with the text themselves. And even if they don't write in their books, they can be doing it in other kinds of ornamentation was the word that we used, thinking kind of illuminated texts and the ways that the margins in old illuminated texts are filled with pictures. So we offered some exercises in which students could really open up the space around the text with their own writing and their own pictures and their own reactions to the text. And it seemed to make it a lot more exciting for them.
So I have to say, as someone who flunked Moby Dick in high school, I had two of the best tutors on Melville's work I could possibly have asked for on this project. And you can get a sense from both of them the passion they have for this book and yet the openness and creativity for thinking about this book in new ways, which is part of what animates this project on reading in a participatory culture. You're up again, Ricardo, and you're going to share with us a second selection.
Yes. In constructing Moby Dick, one of the things that I realized again very recently, you don't have to try to tell the story chronologically speaking, but you have to keep the action moving. And there are times when Melville just bogs down and talking about stuff that is like, what are you doing? And maybe later we'll get a chance to talk about the cetology chapter that ended up in the play in a way that is one of the most remembered parts of the play. But in this scene that I'm going to read now, it really deals with the two captains of the crew. The captain of the young crew is a young girl named Alba. Her little brother Pip was gunned down by the drug lord White Thing. And she puts her crew together to go on a train into the heart of the city to hunt him down and kill him. And if I don't get these glasses on, nobody will see. So this is Alba talking to her crew about going to hunt down White Thing. And I have to read several characters, Dodge, Tasha, and Q. But hopefully you'll hear hear Alba's voice through them all. Alba, why are we really sweating White Thing anyway? He doesn't owe us money, does he? He owes me. He took Pip from me. And I'm going to bring him down, make him die if it's the last thing I do. Alba girl, I miss Pip too. But this is the business we chose. Maybe it chose us, whatever. But everybody knows if you're in the business with White Thing, there are risks, like dying. Damn, Tanisha Marie Lopes. Were you worried about dying when I kept the bank from putting your family out of their house? Stuart Ronson III. Were you worried about dying when a new piano just showed up at your mama's church? Where we were all baptized. A new car makes for a great Christmas, wouldn't you say, Dana Michael Johnson? No hospital will ever dare turn anybody in your family away again, will they, Quentin Morris? You ain't got to guilt trip any of us, Alba. You know us, you know us like we know you, and you run a tight ship. And we know we're in the business where bad things happen every day. Yeah, we are in the business and we know the risk. But White Thing didn't keep it business. He meant to hurt me, and he did. But not just my heart or body or even my soul. He made my world hurt. My mother and father cry all night and look at me with hate in their eyes. A hate that will never go away. There's pain everywhere I go now. The air hurts. The sun hurts. Music that used to cool me out now hurts. The neighborhood where we all grew up has no more comfort in it, just pain. White Thing picked me out of 100,000. He took the most precious thing in my life away and filled that space with pain. And I will give him that pain back 10 times 10. I cannot and will not be stopped. Now, I'm going to light a few candles, maybe even say a prayer. Then I'm going nowhere by yourself. Not even. No way. Not today. Captain Ahab! Captain Ahab! I have heard of Moby Dick. Wasn't that Moby Dick that took off thy leg? Who told thee that? Aye, Starbuck, aye, my hearties all round. It was Moby Dick that dismasted me. Moby Dick that brought me to this dead stump I stand on now. Aye, aye, aye. It was that accursed white whale that raised me, made a poor pegging lubber of me forever and a day. Aye, aye. And I'll chase him round Good Hope and round the Horn and round the Norway Maelstrom and round Perdition's flames before I give him up. And that's why you've shipped 4 men to chase that white whale on both sides of land and all over the sides of earth till he spouts black blood and rolls finned out. What say ye, men? Will you splice hands on it? Now, I think you do look brave. But what's this long face about, Mr. Starbuck? Wilt thou not chase the white whale? Art not game for Moby Dick? I am game for his crooked jaw, and for the jaws of death too, Captain Ahab, if it fairly comes in the way of the business we follow. But I came to hunt whales, not my commander's vengeance. How many barrels will thy vengeance yield thee, even if thou gettest it, Captain Ahab? It will not fetch thee much in our Nantucket market. Nantucket market, hoot! But come closer, Starbuck. Thou requirest a little lower layer. If money to be the measurer, man, and the accountants have computed their great counting house, the globe, by girdling it with skinnies, 1 to every 3 parts of the inch, then let me tell thee that my vengeance will fetch a great premium here. Vengeance on a dumb brute that smote thee from blindest instinct. Madness. To be enraged with a dumb thing, Captain Ahab, seems blasphemous. He tasks me. He heaps me. I see in him outrageous strength with an inscrutable malice sinewing it. That inscrutable thing is chiefly what I hate. And be the white whale agent or be the white whale principal, I will wreak that hate upon him Talk not to me of blasphemy, man. I strike the sun if it insulted me. Take off thine eye. More intolerable than fiends glaring is a dotish stare. But look ye, Sarbuck, what is said in heat, that thing unsays itself. I meant not to incense thee. The crew, man, the crew, are they not one and all with Ahab in this matter of the whale?
So talk to us about the business of naming. We were talking about that outside, and that's a new addition to the play since the last time I've heard it.
Well, it's part of pop culture on one level, but also the first part of it was a reflection of that nobody in Melville's novel, book, I have to remember that from now on, has a full name. You know, there's no Robert Stubb or Willie Flask or, you know, there's Sostego, Dagu, and Queequeg. There's you know.
Peleg and Bildad. They're not even called captain.
Nobody has a full name. And that's such a parallel to the gang culture, because one of the things that you give up in gang culture is your name. And you become something else. You become Chico. You become Blade, you become G-Man, or something like that. You give up something. But when Alba has to bring her crew to heel, one of the things she does is she calls them all by their full name. And she's letting them know, I know you, and I know all of you. And not only do I know you, you need to think about what I have done for you. And almost never, never does she mention what I did for you personally. It's what I did it for your mother. I did it for your church, our church. I made sure that a hospital will never dare turn a member of your family away again. I did that. But Ahab on the crew, in the earlier part of that scene, when they're talking about the well, and Tashtego and Dagu and Queequeg all say, well, we've seen the well. He calls them by name. Aye, Tashtego. Aye, Dagu. Ah, Queequeg. He identifies them. And when you can call a person a thing by its name, it's also saying, I see you. Which showed up recently in a very popular movie. I see you.
Plus he gets the whale a name.
Say it again.
He gives the whale
and
a
he
name.
Gives the, and he defines it. It's this. It's inscrutable malice sinewed. I mean, it's just, he's defining the whale, and Alba is also defining White Thing, the drug lord. He's worthy to die, and I'm going to kill him. But later on in the novel, a policeman tells them, I name you something and it makes you worthy of being killed. It means you're worthy to die. So Melville deals with such some topics that the novel just kept giving. And I put so much pressure on this novel. I tried to crush it. And every novel that I adapt now, I bring in a dump truck and try to run it over. And if it crushes, it's not a work I'm going to stay with. But if it holds up, we got something.
So what are some of the other literary works you've been working with in this way?
I'm doing my adaptation of Frankenstein called Misery's Fiend Frankenstein in April of next year. And the key thing about that is my creature, who doesn't get a name either, who's defined only by Victor, is played by three actors who play the alpha, the beta, and the gamma of the personality. And it's how this thing, we watch it grow up and how it suffers all of these horrible indignities until, you know, The alpha is decisive and aggressive. The beta is thoughtful and deliberative. The gamma holds the humanity, the soul. And when the gamma turns, there's no going back. You've created a monster. And in our society today. So I've also done Don Quixote, where the key thing is honor, the knight's errant, the honor. And a community that rallies for an old man who taught them all Don Quixote, his favorite novel. And then he's losing, he thinks he's Don Quixote. So the last group that he taught, a group of young people, get their cell phones and computers, and they say, we're going to take Poppy on his adventures through the city. And they have to create them as they go, what's coming up? You know, well, we got to find some windmills, you know. And they have to create them and so on. I've also done Frederick Douglass, the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, called The Original American Icon, and which I don't want to go into that right now. And in the not too distant future, I'm hoping to jump. And I've also done the poetry of Paul Laurence Dunbar. And the next thing I'm hope to work on is something by Mark Twain called Pudd'nhead Wilson, which Wynn introduced me to, and it's
yeah,
he was ahead of his time, you know. But his time is now more than ever, particularly with that book.
So we brought you to L.A. and we're putting you to work. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what you're doing here in Los Angeles the next couple of weeks?
Well, on the 11th of October, we'll be staging a Reader's Theater production of Moby Dick Then and Now with students from L.A. schools and students from the University of Southern California, and try to employ some of the new media concepts and techniques of, for instance, on the projector, we sometimes put the text of the Melville's text, sometimes even the young people's text, so that it's reinforced, or visual images that give us a sense of the scope, or even the intense violence in Moby Dick. You know, when you read the novel and you see, you know, people get on a boat smaller than this stage, and they go out and they stab to death the biggest thing that's ever existed on the planet. I mean, you don't shoot it. They didn't shoot it. They stabbed it to death. And the intense violence of that's so intense that it turns the sea red. You know, but you know what? You got to love it. But so it's the same thing with the kids.
Yeah.
You know, when they encounter the hidden thing, you know, it's, you know, Fadala tells them, put your guns away. You have to fight white thing hand to hand. Same violence. So there's a, I forgot the question.
I mean, I think what the audience needs to know is that you haven't cast a single part in this play you're doing.
No, I haven't.
In 2 weeks' time.
Yeah.
So whatever you see on the stage at USC is working with kids from across L.A.,
yeah,
mixed race cast, coming together to produce this play under incredible pressure. And we're going to see what comes out of that. But we think it's an exciting opportunity.
Yes.
For youth here in L.A., both the USC students and the people from the South Central community that we're going to be working with on this.
And also, it's also going to be interesting to see the nature of the urban edge that was apparent on the Pequod and is apparent in the young crew. You know, do you understand that what that edge is and how it can lead you to destruction or save your life?
The other thing they'll get is large swatches of Moby Dick. And I remember,
yes,
when you did the play first in 2007, I think,
mm-hmm,
I walked up to one of the actors. It was Josue.
Josue.
And I said, do you like Moby Dick? And he said, yeah, I really love it. And I said, so we were talking about it. And I said, have you read the book? He said, yeah, I've read the book.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he knew the words that you'd given him to say.
Yeah.
But he knew the book.
He knew the book.
Better than many of the students who leave my class.
And in the video, he says, if you ever need to know anything about Moby Dick, just ask me. he was a great contributor in that in that process. And one of the authors in the book, Rudy Cabrera, who is just a great story in his own right. He played Q, the original Q, and he brought an edge that forced me to, you know, one of the things that happened with the incarcerated students was they gave descriptions. They, you know, one of them said, well, you know, Kukwege is a pimp. He is. It's like, yeah, we meet him. He's dealing human flesh, selling human heads. You know, he's tall, he's strong, he's exotic, he's loyal, he's dangerous. That's a pimp. I'm like, yeah, baby, I guess it is, you know. But then one of the other descriptions that was so good was, Ishmael is like a Navy SEAL, an ex-Navy SEAL, but he was so high-strung they had to kick him out. Now, you think about that. Too high-strung to be a Navy SEAL. And you read that opening.
Yeah.
Segment when he's talking about himself, I'm like, see, they cut to the chase of the essential character. One of them said, you know, he started his story, my name is Stubb, linebacker, middle linebacker. That's it.
That explains
That's Stubb. So, you know, so we try to, you know, and once again, I go back to Henry and Wynne. What they did was there was a passion for the nature of Melville, but there was also a passion to say, let the kids say it the way they got to say it.
You have to do that.
So the reading of participatory culture is not just a print book, but it's also an audiovisual experience. There's an interactive digital book we've developed precisely so we can show the range of media that Melville's book has inspired, and to help people think beyond Moby Dick about how they read and how they engage with a variety of text. And so for my segment, I want to sort of share with you a couple of examples of some of the media manifestations of Moby Dick that have sprung up. As I said, that's what I do. I'm a pop culture guy. And what fascinated me about my Melville is a fan, first and foremost. There's one of my essays in the book is describing the way Melville geeks out about whales across the book and the ways in which that actually parallels the internet discussions we see today among fans and the ways his critique, you know, he's sort of debunking certain representations, he's rewriting mythology and reasserting it, he's debating with other fans, all of that is going on. The minute I started pursuing this, suddenly I realized the strong connection to my fan roots and fan practices, and then there are Melville fans everywhere. So I was speaking at a library in New England and some about this project, and someone came up with his laptop after and played me this video by a guy named MC Lars. And MC Lars is what's called a nerdcore performer. So nerdcore is a white guy's, nerdy white guy's version of hip-hop that often deals with themes from science fiction. But MC Lars has a literature degree. His parents are teachers. He very much is passionate about how to get kids engaged with literature. So he produced this video called Ahab, and we're going to watch Ahab now. Manages to pack Moby Dick into about 3.5 minutes. When we connected through this project, and we started corresponding, we showed the videos to school, the classes we were working with. And one of the things we did was I got the students to frame questions about his video, sent them to MC Lars. He answered them via my blog at henryjenkins.org. And there was something very, very empowering for these kids about just the experience of being able to reach out to someone who'd made a music video they'd seen on YouTube to ask them questions, to get into a conversation about Moby Dick. But some of them said it later, man, when I saw that on a blog, I thought how crappy my writing was and how I should do a better job. And I think that was a very real part of the learning from them, was what it was to write publicly. The same group of students ended up contributing to the Wikipedia page about Moby Dick. And a lot of schools tell kids, don't go anywhere near Wikipedia. But we found that they were actively participated in changing the Wikipedia page to reflect
research they were doing. This being Wikipedia, the community challenged some of their changes. They had to defend it. And at the end of it, they were left, some of them stuck, some of them didn't. But they were left with a much more powerful sense of research as a process rather than research as something that simply is in the pages of a book.
Right.
And so those were some of the powerful teaching experiences we had. Now that M.C. Lars is in L.A., we've connected him to the Robert F. Kennedy School here in near downtown. And he's now been working with kids on Edgar Allan Poe and hip-hop.
All right.
And the group picked the story Mask of Red Death, which for them spoke to class politics in the age of Occupy in a really powerful way. And for them it was about, you know, the rich people are surviving partying while the poor people are dying, and the Red Death crashes their party. So he did if you can look and find online a TEDx video of him with a group of students, mostly Latino students here in LA, performing their version of the Red Death will crash your party. Now the other, while Ms. Hopkins was grading me down on my book report on Moby Dick, I was totally vegging out on Star Trek, right? And Star Trek is for me a really sacred text. And what you discover when you go back to Star Trek is Moby Dick is already there, mm-hmm. right? And particularly in The Wrath of Khan, a film that is very much about reading. And it's about two readers and two books. It opens with Kirk, Spock giving Kirk a copy of Tale of Two Cities. And it ends with Kirk realizing the line, 'tis a far, far better thing that I've done than I've ever done before, was Spock explaining and preparing him for the sacrifice Spock makes in the course of the movie, where he gives his life to save the ship and the crew. And Kirk hears that message, and at the end of the film, we see Kirk recognize what Spock was trying to communicate through this book. Khan is not so lucky, right? So if we can bring the first clip up, I love reading bookcases. I don't know about you, but there's a moment in the very beginning when we first are introduced to Khan, we're actually introduced to his bookcase before we're introduced to Khan himself. And you
Yay!
See right there, there's Moby Dick. There's Milton, there's Dante's Inferno, there's the King James Bible, there's a sign that says Botany Bay, which was the name of his ship. All of those are the allusions that are going on. But as we follow the story, we realize that Khan has in fact misread Moby Dick, that Khan has picked up on Ahab's vengeance. He identifies with Ahab's search for vengeance. He knows the language, but he's going in the course of the film to repeat Ahab's mistake. And so if we can see the second clip, we'll see him. The scene, it's almost like Starbuck and Ahab scenes in the book.
We're all with you, sir. But consider this. We are free. We have a ship and the means to go where we will. We have escaped permanent exile on Seti Alpha 5. You have proved your superior intellect and defeated the plans of Admiral Kirk. You do not need to defeat him again.
He tasks me. He tasks me, and I shall have him. I'll chase him round the moons of Nibia and round the Antares maelstrom and round perdition's flames before I give him up.
Okay. And what we see is he sacrifices his crew, he sacrifices his ship, and his final lines are actually the same, are also Ahab's final lines. So if we'll see this final clip here, we'll see just at the moment of Khan's death, he's reciting Ahab's last lines.
From hell's heart, I stab at thee. For hate's sake, I spit my last breath at thee.
So there's Melville woven through Star Trek, right? And woven through Battlestar Galactica, which we also talk about and dissect in the digital book extension. So, along with the flyers outside about the USC event, you can pick up a thing that shows the digital book and has the URL to it, and there's a lot more there in terms of media that builds on or quotes from or otherwise expresses a relationship to Moby Dick. Now, when you and I are both teachers, and we one of the questions teachers constantly ask us is if we're celebrating remix in the classroom, we're telling kids to appropriate with all the cautions and respect that Ricardo talked about earlier, isn't that just plagiarism?
Yes.
So how do you respond to that?
Well, it's even worse because Melville did it in the 19th century and it makes him a great artist. And then we come into the first day of class and say, the one thing you must not do when you're in this class is plagiarize. So I find it's a really great teaching moment among many because, for one thing, it makes us understand that in the 19th century there weren't strong copyright laws. And people routinely borrowed from each other's work, and it wasn't called plagiarism, it was called writing. So one of the things that makes students understand is how much more we regulate the exchange of intellectual property now than we used to. It's still a problem, but I think understanding that it has this deep historical context is really helpful.
And we work through this at some length in the book and try to explore, is there a way we can assess good remakes or good remixes? And I think a good remix, like the ones we've seen tonight, force us to see something in the original that we wouldn't have seen before. They're adding value, even if they're simply taking the words and attaching it to music or interpreting those words through performance or weaving them through a science fiction story or creating a fan fiction story about them. That remix brings out an interpretation. And so what we're trying to encourage is kids to be both critical readers, close readers, and creative readers, readers who remix, remake, reimagine the classics and get them to speak to their own time. Whereas plagiarism, from my mind, doesn't do any of those things, right? When a kid copies something out of an encyclopedia and tries to pass it off as their own work in my class, they've not sought to call attention to the source they've come from. They've not added anything new to that work. They've taken away from it. So plagiarism is an ethical question. Remix is a creative question. And really good art does remix. But in doing so, it adds enormous value to what we're reading.
And also, I think, when it's done well, it takes you back to the original source, not to the remixer.
Yeah.
And I think that's where a lot of times students get lost, is they're trying to bring it back to them as if they created it. When MC Lars's video takes you back to Melville, it doesn't take you to him, it takes you back to Melville. And I hope in my play that I try to say, go back, you know, go back to Melville. Don't come to me because I didn't write it. Go back to Melville.
All right, so we want to open the floor now and go back to you guys and
right.
See what questions you might have for us. Yeah.
Thank you. You all were fantastic. So, as you were saying, go back to Melville, my question then is, who do you think Melville would have said go back to, aside from the sources you've already cited?
Go back to the Bible, go back to the Vedas, go back to Shakespeare, go back to, you know, I find it very interesting because you say how much he plagiarized, and I'm looking at it going, this man has such a collective knowledge,
yeah.
You know, and I never got the sense that he, when he mentioned something, he was saying, I did it. He was saying, here's the evidence, it's already been written of these. He talks about the Greeks and the mythologies and the Indian and the Polynesian religions and all of those things, but he gives them credit, and I appreciated that about him a lot.
He would also have said, go back to Hawthorne.
Yeah.
And he dedicated the book to Nathaniel Hawthorne, his friend. I think he didn't always go back far. Hawthorne was right next door.
Did Mr. Shandy after Melville?
Way before, 18th century, and he was very interested in Tristram Shandy, the fact that the book never seems to end.
Moby Dick's kind of like that, too.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm a high school English teacher, and I thank you for the stimulating and invigorating discussion tonight. But what strikes me most is the disconnect between tonight and my reality. And I'm wondering, you know, even if the public is aware that there's really no room for Moby Dick in the classroom anymore, and there's room for Melville, but in small snippets, with the Common Core state standards that we are, as we speak, you know, putting into effect, books are kind of out of the classroom. And so, you know, I'm wondering if there's, you know, that's the big, that's your nemesis.
Can you do sections of Moby Dick?
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, because you talked about non-linear reading and all of that and close reading, and that's all good. But as far as books go and this whole experience of reading a book, that's gone.
But, well, I would never say it's good not to read books, but there are some books that high school students probably won't get, and a brief introduction is going to hook them if you can get them excited about it, and they might read it later on. It's a larger cultural problem you're addressing, which is that we don't support the reading of long books the way we may have done in the past. But I'm all for the abridgments and the excerpts now. I can't believe I'm saying this, because years ago I would have just... partly from seeing what it did to Ricardo's actors, who were not reading the whole book at all, and my own students who tell me that they slept through various chapters. I think there's a lot to be gained from reading enough to get them excited and having them read it aloud, because the book can be dead on the page for a young reader, but if you get them reading it aloud, they hear the humor and the wit, and you know, it can be more real to them.
There's also, and I talk about it in the book, about my when I read Mario Puzo's The Godfather, and before I saw the movie. And then I saw the movie, and I felt so rewarded for having read the book, because Coppola did things in the movie that if you didn't read the book, they didn't mean anything. And so part of what I try to do in my teaching process is to say, first of all, this is not about passing a Regents test. This is a lifetime experience. And it may take you 20 years to read Moby Dick, but if you get involved at this level, in the 20th year, you'll get rewarded for something you did back then. Reading, even if it takes them a long time, but keep rewarding them for slogging through the process.
So one of the teachers we quote in the book sort of was doing the annotation and ornamentation exercise that Lynn was talking about, and in the interview said, you know, she thought it was just totally messy process for her. It didn't have the clear goals that she was used to doing. But a student came up to her and said, you know what I learned about Moby Dick? And she said to herself, probably not very much. And the kid said, I learned how much more there is to learn about this book. And that's really, for her, that was a huge payoff, to not have it reduced to cliff notes and things you memorize for the test, but to read just enough and get just enough that you realize what a complex puzzle this really is, and that it could be, if it's the right book, a book you read for your lifetime. And that's really my experience of this book, I was incomplete after high school, but when I read it today, it changed the process of the work, and I found myself now going around the country talking about Moby Dick. Would it shock Mrs. Hopkins to no end?
Yeah.
Okay, there were some more questions back there and some over here. Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Hello, Ricardo.
Hello, Kevin.
just want to say thank you and welcome to L.A. From a fellow Providence, Rhode Islander.
Yeah, thank you.
But I have kind of two questions here. The first one is, what is the response from the remix of Moby Dick throughout the high schools, not just in Rhode Island and throughout the places you have gone, but have there been other responses from high school teachers who may be interested in having what you're doing or that type of program or play or remix in their classroom? And then the other question is, about how many students do you think have read Moby Dick because of the work that, and not just you, Ricardo, but all the work that you guys have done to influence the reading of this book?
Well, I'll answer the second question first. I'm amazed at how many adults who maybe saw their kids in the show went and read Moby Dick. And we talk about in the book about villages. This is this place called the Moby Dick Village. And the key to the Moby Dick Village is read a chapter of Moby Dick. And then you'll go into the village and you'll find other people who have information. And you know, and but in order for communities to improve, mom, dad, grandpa, cousin Bill, and everybody else has to be invested in getting into the Moby Dick Village. And so I'm as much invested in mom and dad reading Moby Dick as I am the kids reading Moby Dick. Because then it becomes, it's like, you know, it used to be like the Bible was. It was a thing we had in common. And or Shakespeare, it was the thing we had in common. And I think we put so much responsibility on learning on students and kids, and adults are not doing anything to enhance that process at all. And so part of my energy in doing Moby Dick forever is to get whole communities of people to read it so they can have something to talk about all their lives. But I...
Okay.
Thank you. I'd like to say, what's in a name? Why did Melville pick Moby? Why did he pick Dick as his novel?
Well, I have to tell you, it's caused some no end of trouble for us working in the schools because school computers have mandatory filters, and we discover that most of the writing about Melville's novels is filtered out of most high schools in America because it has that word Dick in it. So our school computers are the equivalent of sniggering fourth graders who are saying, "Hey, it said Dick." So whatever reason Melville had, and I'll let these guys actually speak to that, we face challenges in schools that have hobbled the computer and blocked access to knowledge because of that one word that's in Melville's title.
And the short answer is nobody knows. But there was a book by Jeremiah Reynolds called Mocha Dick, and Melville knew it. But why he chose Moby, there have been many theories, but nobody knows.
Okay, over there.
Hello, Henry and Wynn and Ricardo. I'm Norman.
Ricardo?
Hey.
I would like to introduce myself as well. My name is Norman Golden II. I actually was a part of the cast of the remake of Moby Dick in 1998. I played Pip, obviously.
You could have played Dagoo also.
You know, maybe. Well, my question, I mean, you know, we've talked a lot about, you know, but well, before I get into the question, I would say, by the way, wonderful presentation. I mean, it's just awesome. As I was sitting here listening to, you know, I really like your, Ricardo, your readings was very, like,
thank you.
I was there, you know what I mean? So thank you all for that. But I have a simple question. What, you know, in terms of the films, you know, the Moby Dick films, because I'm, you know, interested in that. I was a part of that, you know, that remake, and I think it's been maybe two more since the one that was made
at
in 98. Yeah. What's your opinion on, you know, the remixing of the actual, the 1950s version with Gregory Peck?
Well, I'll, as a film guy, I'll take the first crack at this, but... We look at several of them in the digital book extension of this, which is free and online. So, but we do look at the Patrick Stewart version, which I guess is the one that you're in. And there we're looking at the quartermass scene, and we take that speech that Ricardo read so powerfully there and really look at the different ways he breaks down the crew into individuals, forms a connection to them, and brings them back together again. And I think Patrick Stewart, for my money, Patrick Stewart's performance is my favorite of Ahab on film. What we do with the Gregory Peck film is we really look at a moment that most people look past, which is the moment the Pequod first sets out to sea. And it's people talk about there are no women in Moby Dick. Mm. But John Huston found the women in Moby Dick, and they don't speak for the most part in that scene. But you feel the pain, the loss, the sense of longing as they watch their sons, their husbands, go off to sea. And Huston does this beautiful collage of the women on the land, a montage of the women on land, the ship pulling off the sea,
and really says something there that's Houston's unique contribution, I think, to Moby Dick. And I think if I look at a moment of remix there, that's really what's the most poignant moment for me in that particular text. But there are moments, both of those films just do so many interesting things. And what we're seeing in the most recent versions, I think, has been the reclaiming of the Maori heritage of Kwekwe. That's also a really important contribution there. And we look at that in relation to some contemporary expressions of Maori culture, where Maori are remixing their culture with techno to start to say, we're not just of the past, we're of the future. And the talking about the sort of adventure, the grand adventure that their culture has yet to come. And I think that speaks, tells us something about Kwekwe in a really powerful way if we go back to the Hakkas and some of the other aspects of Maori culture. And again, we deal with that in the digital book edition of this project.
Henry and Wynn and Ricardo, I want to make sure we have time to sign your book in the lobby. I want to thank our wonderful guests and our wonderful singers and musicians tonight. Thank you all for coming. I want to remind you about the October 5th.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.